Good morning, friends of the White Way. I trust all is well with you and yours in enjoying the wisdom and compassion of the Buddha. Today I'd like to share with you some thoughts as I approach my 90th birthday. I know some of you are thinking that cannot be true, but well, I can't believe it myself, but it is true. I was born in 1923, and a simple arithmetic shows that I'm 90 this year. It was in 1934, when I was 11 years old, when my father, Kodo Fujitani, along with his large family of 8 children, was reassigned to Moilili Honganji from Pauvela, a small rural village on Maui, to take the place of Reverend Chiho Miyagawa, who had resigned from the Hawaii Kyodan to return to Japan. Reverend Miyagawa had served the Honganji in Hawaii for 30 years, 6 of them at Mo'ilili. Of course, I'm not ungrateful about my longevity, and I'm truly grateful for the rich and eventful life I've been given. But recently, I've noticed some impairment in my short-term memory, and at the same time, a kind of enhancement of my long-term memory. In other words, I began to think about the past more than about the present. I believe this is normal for us old ones. But what I'm suggesting is that since I've been recalling events that took place a long time ago, and I've also been thinking of how we learn some of our Buddhist ideas as we were growing up, I thought I would share them with you. I began to think of Mo'ilili of the mid-1930s. The temple was located in Kapa'akea Lane, and there was a small yard in the front, and across the narrow road was the high wooden fence painted dark green. And on the other side of the fence was the Mo'ilili Japanese language school, whose principal was Ogata Sensei, a good-looking, mustachioed man. Of course, today it is the site of the Mo'ilili Community Center. On the other side of Waialae Avenue, up on King Street, was the stone quarry and the crusher that operated day and night, casting quarry dust on the leaves and the buildings all over Mo'ilili. The Mo'ilili Honganji was a two-storied building facing west. The bottom floor was a social hall, and the so-called sanctuary, the omido, was on the second floor. The minister's residence was also a two-storied structure on the Mauka side of the temple and joined by a covered walkway. I remember our Sunday services were always well attended, and we had very active YBA and junior YBA members. The Tanakas, the Murakamis, the Tandos, the Hokamas, the Haradas, the Gotos, the Satos, and the Kanazawas all lived in Kapa'akea Lane and were active members of Mo'ilili Honganji. Mr. Harry Yoshimura, who was the scoutmaster of Troop 2, also lived in our lane. Many families lived on Nakoko and Kuile lanes, including fellows I hung around with like Teruo or Tebo, Aratani and Joe Ochi. Sadao, whose nickname was Pumpkin, Fujioka, and a few others lived farther away. There was a Chinese family living behind our home, and every Sunday, from early in the morning, they would prepare an emu and have a small kalua pig. I still remember the delicious smell wafting in the air. It seems that in the early missionary days, Jodo Shinshu was considered the faith especially for the Isseis. Bishop Imamura certainly sought to implant Buddhism in Hawaii, but he didn't have the personnel to propagate the Pure Land form, the Jodo Shinshu form, among the young people. The English department established at the main temple was headed by Englishmen. So Buddhism in English for the Nisei was at best a mixture of Mahayana and Theravada Buddhism taught by non-Jodo Shinshu teachers such as Reverend Kirby and Reverend Hunt and Mrs. Hunt, who were Englishmen. Reverend M.T. Kirby arrived in Hawaii in 1921. Then Reverend Ernest Hunt and his wife Dorothy Hunt assumed leadership of the English department in 1924. We know that Reverend Kirby left for Japan in 1926, so he was before our time, as it were. But Reverend and Mrs. Hunt served the Honganji from 1924 to 1937. And in 1937, for some unknown reason, Reverend Hunt left the Honganji to serve the Soto Mission, the Zen Temple, on Nuanu Avenue. One important factor might have been that Reverend Imamura, after serving as bishop for 32 years, died in office in 1932, leaving Reverend Hunt without his strongest supporter. Aside from this recollection of the early days of the Hawaii Sangha, I wanted to mention that in that early period, one constant part of the English service was the recitation of the responsive reading of the Dhammapada, one of the oldest writings in Buddhism. Perhaps because we read it so often, some of us memorized portions of that passages. For instance, the first sentence says, "All that we are is the result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts." And over the years, I've come to see the truth of that statement in many places. I've seen it in my own experiences, such as when I, for some reason, felt unable or unwilling to complete a task. Upon a few moments of positive thinking, like, "I can do it," or "I must do it," or "I want to do it," the task was completed. We can easily see that a negative thought, such as "I can't do it," or "I don't want to do it," would have prevented the completion of the task. A positive thought was certainly necessary. A more compelling example of the importance of thought is of a middle-aged woman in Japan who had been told by her doctor that she had terminal cancer. Her story was reported in the Honganji Shinpo, the newsletter sent from Kyoto to the ministers. When she learned of her dire condition, instead of despairing and bemoaning her shortened life, it is said she responded by being grateful that the normally dreadful disease came as a friend to inform her that, after all, human life is finite and that she ought to live fully and appreciatively the days remaining for her. What we think is important, isn't it? The story of that lady has great meaning for all of us. It tells not only that what we think is important, but also that we shouldn't be unreasonably greedy or demanding, which is a value that Buddhism teaches through the important attitude of moderation. Returning to the Dhammapada, and I think many of you remember this, in the service program, the leader, who may be the minister or lay leader, reads the first part, in this case, "All that we are is the result of what we have thought," etc. Then the response is read by the congregation, in this case, "If a man speaks or acts with a pure thought, happiness follows him like a shadow that never leaves him." Then the leader reads, He abused me, he beat me, he defeated me, he robbed me. In those who do not harbor such thoughts, hatred will cease. Then the congregation follows with, for hatred is not overcome by hatred, hatred is overcome by love. This is an old rule, and so on and so forth. This responsive reading of the Dhammapada was an integral part of the ritual developed by the Theravada segment of the Betsuing Sangha, and one on which we Niseis were nurtured. I believe guidelines of behavior such as that found in the Dhammapada could be used advantageously in the instruction of basic Buddhist thinking, especially among the young people. For us older ones, especially those approaching 90, Bishop Ohara's lesson is perhaps more appropriate. It is that simple poem I have promised to share with you as often as I can. The poem goes literally, when I have time, I look at the mountain. When I am busy, the mountain looks at me. I understand it to mean, only when I have time, I look at the mountain. But even when I am busy and cannot look at it, the mountain is always there looking at me. The lesson is, let us live with confidence because Amida Buddha, no matter what, is always beside us. And so we say with gratitude, homage to the most compassionate one. Namo Amida Butsu.